The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're talking about how humans communicate and how that communication has changed and might continue to evolve over the course of history. A little later, we'll talk about the origins of language with anthropologist Greg Layden. But first, I'm joined by Dr. Michael Korist. Michael is a technology theorist with an unusual perspective. His body is the future. In 2001, he went completely deaf and had a computer implanted in his head to let him hear again. This transformative experience inspired his first book, Rebuilt: How Becoming Part Computer Made Me More Human, which won the Penn USA Book Award for Creative Nonfiction. He's here today to talk about his second book, Worldwide Mind: The Coming Integration of Humanity, Machines, and the Internet. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Michael.
Hello. Thank you for having me on the show.
So, as I said in the introduction, you're deaf, but you have a cochlear implant. So how has that affected your perspective on the whole idea of man merging with machine?
Well, it made me a literal person merging with machine. So it really transformed my perspective, because instead of just reading science fiction novels about human-machine fusions, I suddenly had the experience for real. So that really let me understand that while it actually worked, it was not the same thing as science fiction fantasies of superhuman bodies. So since then, I've been interested in telling the truth, so to speak, about how human-machine interfaces really work.
Well, now your book is, it's very much a mix of the technology that currently exists and sort of a thought experiment, I guess, a potential framework for how we could possibly get to a worldwide mind, as you put it. So what is the worldwide mind exactly?
Well, that is very much the thought experiment of the book, to try to imagine what a worldwide mind is and how we might create one. So I can answer the question on a couple of levels. On the strongest level, you can see a worldwide mind as an entity composed of all the computers in the world and all their users, which has actually achieved sentience on its own. You might call that the Terminator Skynet scenario. I don't think that's a very likely outcome, because as I explained in my book, there's about 100 billion neurons in the human brain and roughly 2 billion computers and 2 billion humans on the internet, giving you 4 billion nodes. So I don't think the internet is anywhere near that point of actual sentience. So I don't think we have that kind of worldwide mind, and I don't know if we ever will. But I do argue in the book that this network of humans and computers has achieved a kind of animal awareness of events. And I use Twitter as a paradigmatic example. When something happens in the world, such as revolutions in Egypt, you get this huge Twitter stream. And I compare that to a kind of animal awareness of events happening in the world. So in that sense, I think we are actually beginning to get a kind of worldwide mind in the sense of a global communication network that reacts organically to events.
Well, we've talked about transhumanism a bit on the show in the past and in something called the singularity. And for those who don't know that term, very, very basically, it's a theoretical point in future history where computer enhancement makes people so smart, so fast, that we can't even imagine what life will be like after that. So how does your concept of a worldwide mind differ from that idea?
It's really a very different idea. I wouldn't say it's an oppositional idea, but it occupies a very different territory. So in the singularity, the idea is that computers suddenly become sentient, and then because they're so much faster than us, that sentience undergoes a kind of asymptotic improvement very rapidly. My skepticism about the singularity, which I discuss a bit in the book, is that right now the internet doesn't really have any external evolutionary pressures to become smart. The reason creatures become smart in the evolutionary process is because they need to. They have to evade predators. They have to find food. And the smarter ones reproduce, and so intelligence tends to go up. But the internet doesn't have that kind of external pressure. So I don't really foresee a singularity in that sense happening. What I do suggest is that the interconnection of human minds and machine interconnections, that is the internet, may achieve or allow us to perform a kind of cognition and a kind of sensation that we couldn't otherwise. So I don't see any compelling reason to believe in Kurzweil's singularity. What I propose is really an alternative model of what the future could look like, of the combination of humans and the internet doing things that neither could do separately.
Why exactly would we want that? And I ask that because I watch a lot of science fiction. And most of the intelligent computers ones, they don't end terribly well for us.
Well, let me shift gears a little bit and tell you about the idea that motivated me to write the book. So a lot of people are anxious that the internet is disconnecting us from each other, that is making us less sociable, that is shrinking our circles of face-to-face friendship, that it is diminishing the fabric of our communities. And this is a very real and very legitimate concern. Now, people tend to answer that in two different ways. There's one camp that says, oh, well, we should just give up technology because it's doing these terrible things to us. Obviously, I don't think that's viable.
No, that's horrible. It's a horrible idea.
And then you've got Kurzweil's singularity, on the other hand, which basically says machines are just going to take over anyway and make humans irrelevant. And I don't find either answer satisfactory. So what I try to do is offer an entirely different kind of solution. We are in a world where our communications are increasingly mediated by machines. And the problem with it is that that intermediation, it doesn't engage our emotions. The technology is about sending text, it's about sending pictures, it's about sending video. But what gets left out is the kind of feelings and the kind of face-to-face information you get when you're talking to someone in person. And even in groups that are physically together, there is a kind of group mentality you can feel when other people are alert or excited or afraid in a collective setting. Those kind of inputs are precisely what we do not get from the internet.
Right.
So in the book, I tried to imagine a kind of technology that allowed us to experience the internet as if it was part of our own sensory experience. And to do that, I suggested, would help replace some of the things that the internet has taken away from us. If we have a way to know whether other people are angry or excited or happy, not just one-on-one, but in distributed collectives across the globe, then we might begin to get some of that back, that sense of emotional engagement in this medium which now presents itself to us as cold and dissociated.
Well, and now there are many challenges to that, especially numerous technical ones, obviously, but there are also conceptual challenges. And one of them was the question that you asked, what does it mean to read a mind? So why is that question an obstacle to making our way towards the worldwide mind?
It's a very important question to discuss and raise because there are a lot of misconceptions about what mind reading means. Does it mean to know the inner speech of a person? Does it mean being able to read their brain's activation states in the sense of, oh, the amygdala is doing this and the frontal cortex is doing that? Yet we have really never nailed down what it actually means to read a person's mind. And it turned out that with current technologies like functional MRI and EEGs, these are a kind of mind reading in the sense that they do give you information about what is going on inside a person's mind. But in the book, I go to really great lengths to say that having that information still does not give you access to the interior experience of being in that person's mind. So you can learn something about what their brain is doing, but it doesn't mean that you know what they are thinking. So I'll just quickly tell you a story of this very interesting technology that allows paralyzed people to type out letters on a screen. So I saw this at a conference a couple of years ago, and a person wears this swimmer's cap that is studded with electrodes. that are reading, they're reading electromagnetic potential activations going on inside the brain. It's actually a very simple technology that's been around for many, many years. And you look at a computer screen that has all the letters of the alphabet on it, and each letter is flashed once. The computer cycles through all the letters very rapidly, so that each letter, if you look at the letter J, you see it flashing a couple of times a second. Look at the letter H, that's flashing a couple of times a second. And when you look at somebody else using it, it looks kind of miraculous. Basically, you see them wearing this strange swimming cap, you see them stare at the screen, and you see letters appear in the part of the screen where their intent is being expressed. And you see words and letters and sentences appear. And it looks like a miracle. It looks like the brain is actually being read by the computer. But in the book, I probe a little bit deeper. What's really going on there? And what's happening is that when your visual attention is fixed on something, like the letter J, for example, and it suddenly lights up, your visual cortex responds in a very distinctive way to seeing that visual change. And the computer picks up that response, and it says, oh, the visual cortex just kind of beeped, so to speak, and the letter J was just flashed. Therefore, I infer that the user was looking at the letter J, and then it puts the J up on the screen. So it looks like it's reading your mind, but what it's really doing is it's observing your visual cortex as it observes things change. It still has no idea what you're actually thinking. And I think that's a really good example of the disparity between what it looks like brain scanning technologies can do and how far that actually falls short of knowing what a person is really thinking and intending and feeling.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm talking to Michael Korrest, technology theorist and author of World Wide Mind, The Coming Integration of Humanity, Machines, and the Internet. Now, you said something that sort of lit something up for me. The idea of fMRIs, they are wonderful, but they are not magic. And I don't think lay people have quite grasped that yet. Could you give people an outline of that?
fMRI, it's a very intriguing technology. You are using an MRI machine, which is this gigantic hulking thing the size of a walk-in closet. It is an enormous superconducting magnet. They slide you inside it, and the fMRI machine basically observes what parts of your brain are sucking up oxygen at any given instant. And so the researchers infer that if this part of the brain is suddenly using a lot of oxygen, then you were using that part of the brain to do something with. You were thinking with that part of the brain. The F for functional means that they take many images rapidly, so you get a kind of a movie of how blood flow is changing in the brain. Now, they can do some very interesting things with that technology. So, for example, if they put somebody in the machine and they show them pictures of, say, Clint Eastwood and Sandra Bullock, they observe your brain activity while you're looking at those two different people, and they basically record that. So they know this is what your brain does in terms of oxygen consumption when you see these two particular faces. If they later show you those pictures again, they can tell which face you're looking at by the way the oxygen consumption levels in your brain change. So in that sense, they really are reading your mind in the sense that they can know your internal private experience of saying, oh, that's Sandra Bullock. And the computer actually knows that. As I describe in the book, it's kind of like stealing $1 out of Fort Knox.
I like the phrase that you used in the book. It was both underwhelming and profound.
Exactly.
That's a lovely phrase.
It is both profound and underwhelming. Really, for the first time in human history, we are able to get some access to things which seem so utterly and absolutely private. If I am thinking of Sandra Bullock, the machine would actually know that, because when I'm visualizing Sandra Bullock, the activation of oxygen consumption in my head would fall into a definite pattern that the computer has associated with my seeing Sandra Bullock. So that's kind of incredible. But on the other hand, if they then show me a picture of somebody else completely, say Hillary Clinton, and they've never recorded me seeing Hillary Clinton before, the computer will have no idea what I'm looking at. So it's not an open-ended kind of understanding. It's basically they train the machine by giving it many test examples.
Right. This is more about pattern recognition.
That's exactly what it is. And the weakness of pattern recognition is that it only recognizes patterns that it has seen before. So that's what is the underwhelming part of functional magnetic resonance imaging. Just because it knows when you're seeing Sandra Bullock doesn't mean that it automatically has access to any other visual experience in your brain. And that's really the single biggest stumbling block to mind reading in the science fictional sense. The fact that although we can correlate things going on in the brain to internal private mental activities, we still don't understand the brain on a deep enough level to be able to look at a sequence of neural activation and say, oh, this means the person is thinking about X. We're just not there yet.
This is an email from Kelly.
How does the prospect of being connected to thousands or millions of other people at once conflict with a sense of intimacy? As it is now, one need only close the laptop or silence the phone to spend one-on-one time with an individual or total solitude with oneself. How would having implanted communication technology change that scenario? Do you foresee this kind of technology having a go-private switch?
It's funny because often when I describe the book to people, the reaction is often, oh my God, I would never want to have that kind of technology. It's both, I don't want other people to know how I'm feeling or thinking, and I personally don't really want to know what other people are feeling and thinking. And I think that this is largely a generational thing. If you look at teenagers, they are much more imbricated in communication networks than their elders are. So in the book, I cite this statistic. The average teenager sends 2,272 texts per month. In fact, that number is probably out of date now because it is 7 years old. So, you have this phenomenon. Teenagers were constantly in this kind of textual communication throughout the day, really almost literally minute by minute. And so there's that hunger for that kind of constant connectivity. And I think most adults experience that too. I mean, my wife practically has to pry my iPhone out of my hand at night because I'm so interested in seeing if there's another tweet or another Facebook entry that's directed to me. But I think that as social mores change, the definition of privacy are going to change. And this has historically happened quite frequently. So, for example, simply the evolution of the city, the growth of megacities, has changed the way people's expectations of privacy work in the sense of when you're in a very large group, you are kind of both anonymous and highly visible at the same time. And this is a state of existence that really didn't make sense to people 1,000 or 5,000 years ago. So I suspect that younger people would see a lot of interest and utility in that kind of radical openness in terms of their feelings and how other people observe their feelings. I do think that there's a cultural shift moving in that direction. Now, whether it's feasible, that's a whole different question. But I think the culture, I think there is this large unspoken desire to move in that direction.
So if we're heading toward a vast interconnectedness of whatever kind, we're going to need more than that. So what are we doing with nanowires?
This is the part in the book where I'm trying to move beyond the facts of now and today and to speculate in an intelligent way about what kinds of technology we might see in the future. When I started writing this book in 2007, I thought the book was going to be an entirely negative book. I thought the book was going to be the kind of book that explained that telepathy of any kind is simply impossible, and we will always have to settle for this kind of the fact that we only can know each other through speech and through touch the way we've known each other for millions of years. But then I started learning about these new technologies that made me think, maybe more is possible than I had thought. And where that started was reading about the ideas of Dr. Rodolfo Linas, who is a neuroscientist at NYU. And he has suggested an idea which sounds frankly crazy, but it's very interesting. What he suggested was that it might be possible to put tens or hundreds or thousands or even more nano-sized wires into the brain through the capillary system, as if you were doing a gigantic angiogram of the brain, so that each of these tiny wires would end up near just one or two neurons and would be able to record their activating or their inhibition. And so it gives you this incredibly fine-grained access to what many thousands of neurons are doing inside the brain. Now, that's a kind of information that we can't get with technologies like functional MRI and EEG. Those technologies give you aggregate information about what millions or even billions of neurons are doing, but they tell you nothing about what individual neurons are doing. It's kind of like trying to figure out what's going on at a party by listening to the rise and fall of voices from outside the heads. So Lunau said, well, maybe there actually is a way to look at individual neurons to get much more fine-grained information about what's going on inside the brain. And with that information, we might be able to make better inferences and predictions about which kinds of neural activation match up with various mental states. For me, that was very intriguing because, first, it breaches the body. Okay, it actually breaches that barrier of the skin and goes into the body and has this very intimate relationship with the brain. So it made me realize that it's not completely unthinkable to invent technology that would get that kind of fine-grained information about the brain, so that even though we're still making inferences, we might be able to make them based on much better information. Now, I learned that there are actually other technologies, including optogenetics, which are potentially both less invasive and more powerful. So for me, the idea of nanowires just kind of got me started down the road toward trying to imagine a literal interpenetration of the computer and the brain.
I have no problem with you continuing with optogenetics, because that's where I'm going, because that field is fascinating.
You know, the word optogenetics sounds kind of underwhelming. It's like, okay, optogenetics, what is this all about? And it's one of those things that actually didn't exist when I first proposed the book and sold it to a publisher back in 2007 or so. The field actually came into existence while I was writing the book. So it was really very interesting. So I was working on the story in Wired, and I traveled out to the labs of Carl Dieseroth, who was out at Stanford. And he showed me this really interesting video in which you see a mouse. In fact, you can find this video on YouTube. So you see this mouse, and it's in a basin, and there is a fiber optic cable that is going into its brain. And the mouse is just kind of walking around doing ordinary mousy things. And then a blue light is shown through this fiber optic cable into the mouse's brain. So the mouse's brain is suddenly illuminated by this very pure wavelength of blue light. And the mouse does something very surprising. It suddenly starts running around in a counterclockwise circle. And it only stops when the light turns off. When you first see that, it's like, wait, what did I see? I saw a light go on. I saw the mouse run around in a circle. What's going on here? And the first thing that you have to understand is how light can affect the brain. Because you would not think that shining a light on neural tissue would do anything, any more than shining a flashlight on a car battery would make it jumpstart, right? As far as we know, light doesn't do anything to mammalian tissues except sunburn you. But there is a way to do it, and you do that by genetically modifying the neurons. What you do is you take the genes out of plants that respond to light, and you insert them into the neurons of a brain. And amazingly enough, those genes that work in plants will also work in neurons. So those neurons, when they see light, they will actually respond to the presence of the light in the same way that a plant does, by some kind of activation. So what happened with the mouse was that the part of its brain that controls its left front leg and its left rear leg, the motor cortex on one side of the mouse's brain controlled the legs on the other side of the body. So when that motor cortex was activated optogenetically by the blue light, that made the legs on one side of the body start to move. And that's why the mouse ran around in a circle. So this was literally the use of light to make genetically modified neurons fire. and that firing means the mouse running around in a circle. So that's optogenetics in a nutshell.
Now, what's the connection to the worldwide mind then?
As I learned more about optogenetics, I realized that not only can it make neurons fire, it can also stop them from firing. And the technique is so precise that it can make individual neurons fire or inhibit individual neurons from firing. And the fiber optics that go into the brain don't actually have to be in contact with individual neurons. You can actually use like little miniature prisms to direct light to individual neurons, even if you're not actually in contact with those neurons. So you can actually put these devices on the surface of the brain rather than pushing them deep down inside the brain and start controlling the way individual neurons, you can make them fire or you can inhibit them from firing. So optogenetics gives you this kind of assembly level, so to speak, control over individual neuron activities. So I suggested that if such a technology allowed you to exert that kind of control over, say, 1 billion neurons. And remember, there's about 100 billion neurons in the brain. That number has actually changed a little bit. The last estimate I've heard was actually there's about 86 billion neurons in the brain. But, you know, a billion here, a billion there, right? But if you can exert that kind of detailed control over a large number of neurons, then you might be able to detect very specific kinds of mental states, especially feelings, because feelings of like anger and happiness and joy, they are very large-scale brain states that are fairly easy to detect. And that's where I came up with the idea of telepathy, that it's conceptually possible to know how a brain is feeling by using a technology like optogenetics. And then once you know that, you can also use optogenetics to evoke neural firing in somebody else's brain to make them feel an analog of that feeling. So that if you're feeling suddenly alert, then your neurons will activate in a certain distinctive way. Your embedded optogenetic rig picks that up, sends a signal to somebody else who is similarly equipped, except there the process works in reverse. That system evokes the neurons in that brain that it knows correspond to a feeling of sudden alertness and makes those neurons do that, which gives that other person a kind of an echo, a kind of a shadow of the experience that your brain just had. So that's the kind of brain-to-brain communication that I suggest we can at least begin to conceive of, which I don't think was really thinkable in 2007 when I first started writing the book, but is now thinkable as of 2011 when the book came out.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back to talk more about the worldwide mind with author Michael Korist after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Dr. Michael Korist, technology theorist and author of Worldwide Mind, The Coming Integration of Humanity, Machines, and the Internet. Now, we have a veritable myriad of questions, so we'll get to some of these. This is from Tony.
With so many people already addicted to the internet and their smartphones, wouldn't physical connection to the internet be like giving addicts an unlimited supply of their favorite drugs?
That's a great question. That is the question I directly ask in the book and try to deal with. And in fact, I talk about internet addiction, which I think is better described as really compulsion. It's not addiction in the sense drug addiction is, but it definitely encourages compulsive behavior. And I talk about that at some length. I talk about the way games like Angry Birds and Twitter hijack dopamine circuitry in your brain, make you always crave that next little bit of stimulation, that next little hit of a message. So there's no question that there is that huge risk of, exactly as you say, giving drug addicts a drug that is actually 100 times more powerful than what they had before. And that does lead to that nightmare scenario of people endlessly connected to the internet and never actually talking to another person. And the solution to that is not technological. The solution to that is social and educational. There is no shortcut to getting there. So in other words, I think this kind of drug is a very real possibility. And the only way to counteract those baleful effects is to keep reminding people over and over again how important communication and empathy and compassion and physical connection are. And I spend a good deal of time talking about how our brains and our bodies respond to touch and how integral it is to our sense of bodily integrity and emotional health. And you really cannot dispense with that and remain healthy. So the book is not an, oh my God, let's all hook ourselves on the internet and we'll all be happy ever after. It's really a call for imagining these incredibly powerful technologies, but realizing at the same time that we have to have humane social structures that let us take advantage of them. So to use a very simple example, we have these powerful technologies that let us get around. They're called automobiles, right? But we don't just hand people automobiles and let them drive them. You know, you have to take a course, you have to be trained, you have to be licensed. So I can envision a future where people are actually trained from a very early age in the skills of communication and intimacy. And in fact, there are some interesting kind of after-school programs that do this. And you know, I think that's very important. And I imagine a future where that's an integral part of our education.
We have a question from the website from David.
As far as we know, the human brain is better than any other brain at handling abstract thought. Will a worldwide mind be able to process abstract concepts better than an individual person? If so, would that ability benefit the people connected to it?
In the book, I really don't talk about abstract thought that much. And I think that abstract thought is something that would be really difficult to do with a worldwide mind, or at least with the internet as it's now constituted. Because to do abstract thought, you have to have consciousness. You have to have an eye that has intentions, that has wants. To think abstractly about something, you have to want to think about it. And if you don't have that, then you really can't think in any real sense. Just to give you an example, computers can beat human beings at chess, any human being alive. But those computers can't learn checkers, nor can they desire to learn checkers. So I think that a worldwide mind that has its own abstract thoughts, the current infrastructure that we have is just nowhere near big enough in terms of magnitude, nor the complex enough to allow that kind of cognition to go on. As I said, there's 4 billion nodes on the internet, humans and machines together, and anywhere between 86 billion and 100 billion neurons in the internet, I mean in the brain. And by the way, in the brain, many neurons get input from 10,000 other neurons, which is an extraordinary degree of interconnectivity that is really far beyond what any individual human being gets in his or her day-to-day life. So that's why I talk about feelings rather than cognition. That's why in the book I focus on telepathy, on not so much knowing what people are thinking. And remember, we have these great technologies for doing that already, the telephone, texting. These are ways to know where another person is thinking. But I imagine scenarios where groups could work together more effectively by knowing the feelings of the other members in the group. So I imagine, for example, a police group doing a drug bust. By the way, I've been trying to think of more peaceful examples, but this example it's at least easy to understand. So let's say you've got this small group of cops, okay? We have to go into this very dangerous environment with all sorts of unknown hazards. And it's dark, it's complicated. They don't really know what's going on with each other, except by talking, which may not be that feasible either in that kind of environment. But if each person had a way of knowing when someone else was feeling pain, and who was feeling pain, in a wordless kind of way, then they would have that ability to react very quickly to each other's immediate states in a way that would be very difficult to duplicate just by talking. So that's one kind of example of where I imagine where the kind of emotional interconnectedness would allow groups to communicate in a way that is more cohesive than we can really do with technology that are cognition-oriented. That's another thing. I think, you know, the internet, what it doesn't allow us to do is to directly share feelings. And if we can do that, that really opens up whole new sets of possibilities.
We have a question from the website from Alex in Guatemala City.
This all sounds great, but I wonder, who will supervise or regulate it? I don't know exactly how it works, but if you're talking about getting into my head, isn't that an invasion of privacy?
Indeed. That's another great question. And I spent some time discussing that in the book. Well, we have some really good parallel examples going on now in Facebook. So there have been all of these controversies about privacy in Facebook, about who gets access to your photographs and to your postings. And there's this sort of constant tug of war. You know, in Facebook, you can set with a fair degree of specificity who gets access to your posts and who doesn't. Google Circles gives you even more access. You can specify that only these groups of people get to see these things I put, and that group of people doesn't get to see it. So we are beginning to see an infrastructure of privacy protection on the internet. And if you look a little bit further back in time, we have all these antivirus programs that protect your computer from the fact that it is connected to the internet. If you think about it, if you want your computer to be completely safe and private, you have to disconnect it from the internet. But when you do that, you suddenly lose 80% of its value. So being connected is a double-edged sword. It is inherently beneficial. It is also inherently risky. And this is true not just for computers, but for people. So whenever you expose yourself to another human being in a loving relationship, in any kind of relationship, there's always that mixture of threat and the possibility of reward. The two cannot be dissociated. So my response to your question is, absolutely, privacy is going to be a big issue. But the way we do it is not by refusing to counter the technology, but by developing countervailing structures in software and social mores to allow people control over who has access to what parts of their minds. Now, to come to your question of who sets these up, that's a really big and important question. So if you look at Facebook, which I think, again, is the most relevant contemporary example, it's a private for-profit company. And there's all sorts of interesting push-pull tensions there because Facebook, as we all know from recent IPO, is trying to prove that it can make money.
Right.
And so we are in this weird social position of this intensely personal, private environment where people share very personal and private things about themselves that is controlled by a company that is trying to figure out how to make money off of it. And there really is still no final resolution to that problem. And if you're on Facebook, you'll periodically see these messages that people send around saying, hey, you know, you better get in your settings and turn these things off. So there's this constant push-pull. But the bigger point is that that's unavoidable. There's always going to be some degree of risk. Your computer is always at some degree of risk by virtue of being connected to this incredibly powerful whole of the internet. But on the whole, the benefits of being connected are greater than the benefits of being not connected. The benefits of being in a relationship are greater than the benefits of not being in one. So there is no escape from that kind of risk. We can only try to manage it as thoughtfully and humanely as we can.
We have a question from Gordon.
This technology isn't going to be cheap, especially at first. Will this affect the way it spreads to poorer countries or individuals? Could the cost wind up being a barrier to a truly global network?
The questions of class and economics are extremely important. Let me just talk about this as a cochlear implant user for a moment. So I actually have this implanted technology. And so what a cochlear implant does, I mean, I would just suggest just Google it and you'll find out how it works. But just briefly, I'm completely deaf. There is a computer chip that has been surgically installed in my skull underneath the skin that has 16 electrodes that connect to the auditory nerves in my inner ear. And I wear something on my ear that looks a little bit like a hearing aid that has a radio transmitter that sends sound signals through my skin to the implant. The implant uses that sound information to decide which electrodes to trigger. And as those electrodes fire, my auditory nerves send signals to my brain. And I've learned to hear those signals as sound. That I talked about in my first book, which was titled Rebuilt, How Becoming Part Computer Made Me More Human, which is also in paperback as Rebuilt, My Journey Back to the Human World. So that technology, as you might expect, that's expensive. It's $50,000 per year. And I have two of them each year. And as you might expect, this is largely a first world technology. There's something like 240,000 implant users in the world. I forget the exact number. But most of them are in the United States, Europe, Australia, with a much smaller percentage in countries like India and China. So this is a very real issue in the cochlear implant world. Because basically, if you're deaf, it's much better to be deaf in a rich country than it is to be in a poor country. So actually grants the premise of the question. But I also want to point out that technology does tend to filter and become cheaper in dramatic ways. So in many African countries, they never have developed a landline telephone system. They just leapfrogged it to cell phones. So many fairly poor people have access to cell phone technology in a way that was unimaginable 10 or 15 years ago. And again, often this happens because thoughtful governments and thoughtful nonprofit organizations make it a priority to do that. And I would hope that would remain true. I mean, I would point out in countries like Egypt, one of the reasons we knew what was going on during the whole revolution in Tunisia, in Egypt, was because people had texting devices and Twitter and had access to it. You know, probably far lower incomes than the first world, but nonetheless, they had that connectivity.
I have to ask, because we have time for one more question, and it's mine. So how likely do you think that the idea of a worldwide mind is going to be? Is this one of those ideas that, you know, in 10 to 20 years, like everything else that sounds really great in tech?
Well, again, it depends on what you mean by a worldwide mind. If you mean a worldwide mind in the strongest sense, in the sense of a sentient, independent, global brain, sort of on the scale of Ray Kurzweil's singularity, I'll say this. I mean, I have read Kurzweil's books. You know, they're massive. And they're full of graphs, you know, showing you asymptotic improvement. But he never really explains how quantity turns into a qualitative change. And I don't think anybody has a clue how to make computers feel, how to give them a sense of consciousness and identity and a sense of wanting. So I don't think we're going to see a worldwide mind in the sense of an independently sentient global entity. I don't see any path that we're already on that we know gets us there. We still don't know what consciousness is. Okay, so in that sense, I don't think it's very likely. But in the sense of a distributed network where we are constantly getting signals of what's important, emotionally important, politically important, we're already beginning to have that with things like Twitter. And I think that it is not implausible to think about technologies existing in 30 or 40 years, maybe using some kind of nanotechnology where you put little devices in the bloodstream that then hook up neurons in the brain and start gathering information about them, that would allow the computer to know, in some statistical sense, and probabilistic sense, this is what's going on in your mind, and to transmit some information about that to other brains, where they would use that to feel more connected to you for ways that are practical or emotional or part of relationships. I mean, I think that what I achieved in the book was to open up that possibility as a conceptually real possibility in a way which I don't think anybody else has. And I think that's what made the book valuable and interesting, because it allows us to talk about this kind of communication in a very concrete technological sense rather than as just a science fiction fantasy.
So what you're saying is baby steps.
Baby steps.
Baby steps. Michael, thanks very much for being here.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You can find the link to Dr. Michael Korrest, the author of Worldwide Mind, on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, you are always encouraged to click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, so that you can keep up with show news, and to iTunes, where you can download an episode or subscribe to the show.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're discussing some fascinating science focused on the liquid portions of our big blue planet. We're joined by graduate researcher Andrew David Thaler, founder of Southern Fried Science, to talk about the weird and wonderful networks of life that exist in the deep sea. And University of Alberta researcher David Schindler joins us to talk about the work and the uncertain future of freshwater ecosystem research at Ontario's Experimental Lakes area. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
We're not quite done with this week's episode of Skeptically Speaking. Since we just spent a bunch of time talking about the future of human communication, we thought it might be nice to give you a bit of the history of it. To help, I've invited our resident cultural anthropologist, Greg Layden of Greg Layden's blog. Hello again, Greg.
Hi, Desiree. Nice to talk to you.
So what was the earliest method of human communication?
Well, nobody knows. Nobody has any idea. We think that a large part of the modern human brain is devoted to language functioning. And language functioning is something in humans that is unique to humans. Even though other animals communicate, there is almost nothing in any other form of animal communication that is even remotely like human language. And we think a large part of the human brain is devoted to that function. So it's been assumed that when human brains got larger, that could have come along with language. It could have actually been the reason brains got larger, or it could have been that as brains got larger, that gave us linguistic capacities. So the debate in evolutionary studies of humans now is whether or not language is early or late, because brains get big with Homo erectus. Brains get big about a little under 2 million years ago, quite a bit larger than earlier brains. But then they more or less kind of almost double in size over the next couple of million years. So at any point along the way, you could argue you have enough brain to be linguistic. People have been looking for evidence of language areas in the brain surfaces you would see in the inside markings of skulls that give you a rough idea of the shape of the brain. And there are people that firmly believe that you can do this and it tells you things. And people like me who are more skeptical, I don't think you can do that, partly because language hardly uses any part of the brain that is completely novel to language. All the parts of the brain that language uses were already being used for something else, and those areas have expanded. So if you see those expanded in an early brain, it might not mean a linguistic takeover of those parts of the brain. It might just mean that other functions were being used more. I go with the language as being very early argument, which is the same argument that we've used for the argument for early marriage. Or an early pair bonding in humans. When you have a highly dimorphic ape-like ancestor who was a tool user, a little bit at least, giving way to a much larger bodied Homo erectus, which has much less dimorphism, where the males and females are much more similar in size, and there's evidence that at that time fire was being used as well, probably for cooking. At that point, humans are in a new situation that wasn't true for our nearby relatives at the time that were more ape-like, in that we had to negotiate social contracts with each other. It looks like humans started to forage in such a way that they brought food from distant places back to a central place to eat it sort of together. You have to have a central place to bring your food to cook it, if you're going to use fire to cook the food. And apes just can't do that. Living apes don't share food much. They don't like to be near each other when they're eating. They like to forage alone. And it's very hard to imagine Australopithecines being much different than chimpanzees in this regard. But we are very different. We bring our food together, even despite what experiences you may or may not have had in college. You can actually bring your food to your house, put it in your refrigerator, go to work and come back, and it will be there, even if you have roommates or family members, usually. And we can actually sit down. We actually gather together to eat. This is like antelopes flying or fish walking down the street. You know, if you look at everything, if we really look at apes and ape behavior, and then someone told you, if you knew everything about apes and nothing about humans, and someone told you they found a species of apes where the apes gather their food together, don't eat it, and carry it to a central place and sit there with each other and eat it and share it, you would not believe them.
When would written communication have developed them, approximately?
This early communication must have been just something that allowed humans to form social contracts, to allow that kind of thing to happen. And that didn't have to be anything like modern language. It might not even have been language as we define it today. Written communication is much later. Homo erectus is somewhat under 2 million years ago. Modern humans emerged hundreds of thousands of years ago or less. Some people think that there's a 40, 50, 60,000 year transition that humans underwent, that before that we're different, and after that our brains, our symbolic and linguistic abilities are different, because that's when we first see the first real stuff that might really be like art or adornment or decoration. And then the dates of early written language is thousands of years ago. It doesn't even date to the origins of agriculture. It's even after agriculture. So written words emerged in several places around the world, and for very different reasons and in very different ways. So it emerged among Native Americans distinctly differently than in China, which is among the earliest, distinctly different than in the Nile Valley, and so on. And so that's really recent for humans. That's like in the big history of you, the human race, the origin of written language and the origin of Facebook are more or less simultaneous.
Wow, that's a great parallel. Thanks. Well, in what other ways has communication changed over time? Even the concept of it, I guess.
Well, one thing I think is really interesting is that if we look at the last couple hundred years where we have people writing stuff down and recording things ethnographically, around, like what we call the ethnographic present, sort of before Western society takes over everything, one of the things we see is that there's a very large number of languages. In an area the size of North America, where today there are predominantly three languages spoken, French, English, and Spanish. And there's a number of Native American languages, but they're really spoken by a very small number of people. In that same region, when it was only Native Americans living here, there may have been thousands of languages. The same in any given area that big any, around the world, unless some language comes in and kind of spreads around and takes over. Arabic, the colonial languages of French and English, Portuguese and Spanish. Colonial languages have taken over large areas and become a lingua franca in over a very large area. That's a fairly recent phenomenon. So one characteristic of communication that's older, that's not modern so much, there's two aspects. One, having a lot of languages spoken over a relatively small area, and then most individuals speaking many languages. I think it's very interesting that Americans don't often speak many different languages. They often speak only one, English, or maybe two. And I'm always a little slightly shocked when I hear people like Steven Pinker talk about language and talk about how children are linguistic geniuses and easily can learn languages, whereas adults can't really do that. But around the world, there are entire societies where adults just pick up new languages as they need to. It's probably partly because they already know three or four or five languages, not necessarily closely related languages. So adding new languages is not so hard. They're just good at that. It's a thing that humans are just good at. Except when you grow up in a world where you only learn one language, and then we become linguistic dummies as adults. So I think that's an important characteristic. In the past, in the recent past, so our species as we exist now, but before modernization and westernization, had the characteristic of large numbers of languages in small areas, and individuals, most individuals, knowing several languages, and even having some kind of specialization or division beyond that, where you might walk into an area where the men – there's a language mostly the men know and a different language mostly the women know. Not that the other sex can't know it. It's just that there are some sexual differences in languages.
Interesting.
Serge Bahouchet, who is a linguist and anthropologist who worked with the Baka pygmies, claimed that as he would go into the forest with the pygmies, leaving the pygmies speak languages, the language spoken by their villagers, the language spoken by the farmers that they would associate with. They speak the same language. They don't have their own language, as it were. But when they walk into the deep forest with Bahouchet, anyway, he claimed that their language would transform. So by the time they got into way far away from the villages in the deep forest, he, who knew their language, could no longer understand them. It was like a change of dialect. So it's almost like if you're from New York and you move somewhere else and adapt to the local language, and then you call your mother, your New York accent comes back. It's like personal dialect shift, depending on where you are at the time.
Well, are there any societies that haven't developed the written word?
Well, yeah. I mean, like, for example, the F.A. pygmies and the Lesse, you know, who go to school, learn to write a little bit, but the pygmies do not read or write at all. they don't have any need for it, and they don't have the facility to do it. They don't have, you know, they don't have paper to write on. They don't have things to read. So they just don't do it at all. And just because something's written down doesn't make it more true than pretty repeated and well-known oral history. It doesn't make it less true or more true. The reason why we can believe something isn't just because it's written down versus not. And I think a lot of people these days in societies with writing don't understand that in societies without writing, there is actually information. And it's passed on orally. And it's important information. And it's usually pretty accurate information. Or at least it's not any less accurate than the written canon of some other society that has everything written down. I mean, is the Quran really more accurate? Is the Old Testament really more accurate than Native American stories that are not written down? I don't think so. If people who are really tied to the written word have said some pretty dumb things, that if it isn't written down, possibly would be out there and in real life. And I actually heard a pair of authors who had edited a new volume, a new version of an old series of stories, who claimed that we were not completely sure on which emotions were typically held by the ancient Greeks, because not all of the different emotions we recognize today were written down. I think that that doesn't give sufficient weight to the simple fact that humans have gone on for many thousands of years with language, maybe 50,000 years, maybe 400,000 or 500,000 years, maybe 1,000,000 years, using language as their way of keeping track of everything and keeping track of each other and so on. And we use things very differently now. I think it's very interesting, apropos the larger picture of like the sort of, you know, a future where when we may merge humans and machine or something like that. In a way, we've already transformed ourselves a lot as it is because of the written word, because we can write stuff down, and because we use text so much, and now with electronically retrievable and producible text even more so, we are transforming perhaps human abilities, and not always in a good way, but transforming human abilities to remember things, transforming human abilities to exist in a kind of linguistically rich spoken milieu that's just different than a written down one. And I also find it interesting that these modern transformations are one of the things you need to do if you're going to transform everything into electronic media and have a very modern way of communicating, is you do need a lingua franca that's much larger scale. And that has become English, which is fortunate for us English speakers. And as one or two or three or four languages spread over large areas and take over and become the main language, they eventually may become the only language over large areas. And that linguistic richness that existed before is lost. And we don't, linguists and anthropologists don't want to preserve ancient languages just because they're artifacts. They actually are ways of representing how people think. At some fundamental level, people are all the same, but the linguistic expression of a culture can be very different from in one culture than another culture. And if you go to one of these places in the world where there's many languages spoken, or when you travel 300 kilometers, you've crossed 10 language zones. And when you meet this person, they speak five languages, and you get into a conversation with 15 people sitting around. I've done this where you hire lots of people to dig an archaeological site. You've got people who know collectively maybe a dozen languages, and they're having a conversation while they're working. And people switch from one language to another depending upon what they want to say, what the kind of thing they're talking about is. They'll just shift. Westerners can understand this because we've all heard that, you know, French is a language of romance, and German is a language of scientific precision. We kind of have a sense that different languages are good for different things. But imagine a world in which everybody knows the same three or four languages, and there's another three or four languages floating around that a smaller subset of people know. And they really have different feels. You use them differently to say different things. They're like different tools in a toolkit. And that's something that we are, I think Western society lost that a century ago. They have no idea about that now.
Greg, I could talk to you about this all day, but we're out of time. Thank you for coming.
I appreciate being on.
And that's it for us. We'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between
the lines of these lies. Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.